Catherine, the other day you mentioned in passing something about nothing not being nothing, and I didn't want to bring I didn't want to follow up then because I had some place to be, but I put it in my pocket as a, you know, a conversation to have later with Catherine, because I don't understand this preposition of nothing being nothing but being something. And then you kind of went off a little bit just on all the different things nothing could be. Would you like to elaborate?
Wow. I vaguely remember that.
Oh, great.
It's just I guess my mind works so fast sometimes. And I guess I thought it was a construct of nothing. Like nothing is something and nothing.
Well, but what is something of nothing if nothing is nothing?
I don't know. It's just like, where do words come from? Nowhere to somewhere.
Well, in this particular case, my interpretation of nothing means that there's... it's empty. It's devoid. It is nothing.
But so is a bottle filled with air.
No.
Yet there's still a container.
Well, okay. This is a good way to start off with me being super pedantic. Air is something. Air is not a void.
Okay.
And even space is not a complete void.
Okay. Maybe it's just more theoretical.
Well, even theoretically, I mean, do you see it as some kind of nexus or why did you have that feeling that there was something more to nothing than nothing?
I think it's just coming from the sense of just living in a void for the past year.
Okay.
You know, living in this, like, what I write about, like, this cocoon that used to be formerly known as my house. And it feels like so much has been, you know, what is something? What is nothing? What are relationships? What is, you know, the purpose of getting up and breathing every day in this, like, weird bubble we've lived in? And I think that's where it was coming from in terms of, what does it all mean?
So you were defining your past year as being nothing compared to the years that you had before that?
Right. It was nothing. Well, it was nothing in terms of like how we would, you know, in terms of productivity, in terms of, all, you know, but it was like yin and yang. It was one thing, like there was nothing going on, presumably, because there were limited social interactions or zero, yet I was busy constantly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, taking care of your parents.
Right. And so it was like, but I didn't feel that I was getting anywhere. I felt like I was a hamster on a wheel.
Right. So you were doing a lot of work, but you weren't getting any output.
Absolutely
not.
No output. No, nothing. No, nothing. It just felt like nothing. And I'd wake up sometimes and take that first breath in the morning. It's like, oh, fuck, I'm still here. Okay. And you do it again. It was like the weirdest version of Groundhog Day.
Oh, the bad version. Yeah.
Yeah, the bad version.
Because you couldn't actually.
I don't want to get too heavy, but maybe that's where it was coming from.
All right. Are we done with nothing? Or
I think we're done with nothing.
Okay.
That went nowhere.
No, I think you exactly explained what you meant by nothing.
Okay.
So, as our homework?
Yes.
For this episode?
Yes.
Which is episode number one?
Episode number one.
Or is it number zero? I don't know. Is this the pilot?
I think it's zero. Let's start at zero.
All right. That seems a little pretentious.
So what?
Okay. I can't argue with that.
So what?
I do like nothing, though.
Okay.
The title of the show might be nothing.
Okay.
It's not Seinfeld nothing, though. That's a different nothing.
Okay. I never watched Seinfeld, but I know. I'm sorry. Edit that out.
I know. I'm not. How? No way.
Actually, that's a lie. I watched Seinfeld twice. Once I turned it on, and it was the episode where they were doing something with a bread loaf. And then, like, fast forward, like, 6 months later, and I'm in, like, Delaware visiting family, and Jerry turned on the TV and it was the same episode.
You're in the Matrix.
I was.
There's only one episode of the of
same
Seinfeld.
Thing with Friends. I know. Same thing with Friends.
So you watched a couple episodes of Friends?
I watched the same episode twice of Friends.
I think there might be something wrong with you. This might be an ailment.
It's something. See? I mean, what
did you know that, according to NPR, Desi Arnaz invented reruns?
No, I did not know that.
This is amazing. They had, now, you know, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with NPR.
Mm-hmm.
Because they also brought Andy Warhol back into my life for some inexplicable reason.
Oh, my God.
But this is a great segment on him and Lucille Ball and how they were pioneers in television. They were the first ones to use film cameras for a sitcom.
Right.
And they used three of them, which was also a first, which is why their show still looks so phenomenal today.
Right.
You know,
uh-huh.
Everything. The Honeymooners is interesting, but it looks like crap. I mean, just visually.
Yes.
But Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball, they had this three film cameras to shoot their show. And the studio did not want to do that because it was very expensive. So the deal they made was that, okay, Desi, we'll give you these three cameras, but you have to take a significantly lower salary. I'm sure that nothing had to do with the fact that he was Cuban. You can laugh more when I make Snyder.
I'm sorry, that was just so weird. Okay, that was okay. Go ahead.
Well, it turns out, you know, so they were filming these things, and he said, okay, if I'm not getting paid that much, I get to own the film. And the studio's like, okay, sure, whatever. I mean, it's garbage once it's been aired. Who needs that? So they had these reels of shows that were piling up. Now I feel I'm just like ripping off NPR here, but they had these reels of old shows just piling up. And one day he said, you know what? We don't have to make new shows all the time. We can just show the old ones again.
I did not know that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I could go on. I could just, you know, basically repeat this whole NPR piece because it was a great piece, but I think maybe I should stop there because okay. Then I'm just going to be NPR.
That's very interesting.
Speaking of Andy Warhol.
Yes.
I don't like Andy Warhol.
I know
no,
you don't.
Let me restate that.
Okay.
I don't dislike the man. I'm happy for him that he was able to make a lot of money and a big splash and, you know, get the kind of fame that he was after, but
right.
His work is devoid of meaning. It's almost like it's nothing.
Perhaps.
Are you going to defend or?
I'm neutral on Warhol. I think that I fell into the abyss, you know, and like when you're looking at things and people tell you it's good and you're young and impressionable, and then you see like Marilyn or the first time I saw Warhol, it was in Chicago. It was an exhibit, and I remember they had the big soup cans on the wall, and I was younger, and everything seemed so, it was just so avant-garde, and it just seemed so awesome. And then I thought it was really stupid.
Wait, you when know, did you think, when you saw it, you thought it was avant-garde, but then when did you think it was stupid?
Probably like within minutes of past the piece, it was just like, had that impact. And so he's like 15 minutes of fame, it's kind of like 15 seconds of interest. You know, and it just, I thought, you know, then you get that whole concept, like we were discussing with minimalism, like, oh, I could do that. I could do that, you know, but you didn't. And I thought, why? You know, what is that representative of? Marilyn, you know, the bust of Marilyn. And I thought it was performance art masquerading as visual art.
Do you think performance art is a genuine field of art?
Not necessarily, but I think it's a subset.
Well, I don't really think of it. I don't understand what performance art is because we have these ideas of what medium, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a painter, you paint.
Right.
You draw, you draw. You know, these are specific mediums. And if you're a comedian, then that's your medium. If you're a singer or a dancer or any of these other things, that's your art form. Performance art feels like you're doing something that you want to be art, but you haven't figured out what your medium is, and you haven't really figured out how to do it yet.
Exactly. It's almost like that caricature. Like when, as you were talking about that, I was thinking in terms of like even celebrities, you know, kind of putting on their brand. And I agree with you. I think that it's like, I don't even know if it's a genre. I don't know if it's a subset. I don't know if it's a construct or someone just made up. But I recall... like going to First Friday years ago on Grand.
Here in Phoenix.
Yeah, here in Phoenix. And there was a guy dressed up in a bunny suit. Or no, a teddy bear suit. I think it was a teddy bear suit. And he said, free hugs. And my partner at the time, I'm like, don't go in for the free hug. And he did, of course. It was ridiculous. And that guy said he was a performance artist. And he was just walking around in a costume.
He's a furry. Do you know what a furry is, right?
I do know what a furry is.
Oh, good.
I don't know if he was a furry. But then he let us into the exhibit, which was an exhibit of all these, like, still, it was, you know, visual art with these huge paintings of bears doing this variety of activities. And as you walked through this exhibit, and at the end, there was a little movie about the bear going up into outer space. And so the whole piece, and so and I was a little confused, and I thought, well, they're hitting all aspects. And then the artist talked after the movie aired and said that the entire piece from the time that the teddy bear greeted us with the free hug was their visual representation, was their performance art, that even the visual art was part of that because we were experiencing it at that moment in that group.
Well, that is okay. That's an interesting area of might be referred to as environmental art. I'm thinking of an artist named James Turrell. Do you know him?
Sounds familiar. Yeah, but he's, I can't say
he does some weird stuff. He does a lot of environments. Like he'll make a huge earthworks just to line up the sun at a specific, you know, to basically to make a solstice machine.
Okay.
But then he'll also create these installations where he has, you have to swim down through a pool underneath a wall and come up and in this amazing lighted area.
Wow.
So he creates these crazy spaces. Now, I haven't seen much of his work, but I did see one of his pieces that he installed at the college I was going to at the time, and I was pretty well taken with him, which is unusual because I usually need a little more concrete work to sink my teeth into. But back to this teddy bear thing.
Right.
Did it make you feel anything?
It was years ago, and I'm still talking about it.
Talking about it is one thing, but did it make you feel anything?
The teddy bear freaked me out. I don't like people dressing up in costumes like that. I thought it was weird and it made me uncomfortable. And then I was kind of curious. And then at the end, it was just sad when the teddy bear went up into the space capsule. It's like he wanted to escape his, you know, furriness. I don't know what the hell it was about, but I remember feeling really sad.
Was it, a bittersweet sadness? Was it?
No, it was just sad. It was just, I couldn't wait to get the hell out.
Oh, okay. So that was more of a negative response to the work.
Yeah. And then, but that was the whole work and I didn't know the point. And I'm like, I just don't get it.
Because it might be useful if we're talking about art or things that try to be art or pretend to be art to define what art is.
Exactly.
Go.
It's just that, what is art? I mean, well, Warhol, your buddy, said it's whatever you can get away with.
Did he say that?
He did, didn't he?
I don't know.
Let's quote check that.
Yeah.
But I do believe he said that. It's like, what is art? It's whatever you can get away with or something to that effect. We can Google it later.
That sounds like a Duchamp quote.
Let me see.
Okay.
American artist Andy Warhol. Everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. Art is what you can get away with.
Yeah, see, that's not what art is, though. That is a great quote, though. And that sounds, you know, perfectly in keeping with his persona.
He also said, I am a deeply superficial person.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of nonsense I say, too. But I'm not famous, so nobody cares. Yeah. And I'm not upset that no one listens to my nonsense because I'm not famous. You know, that he got to be famous, and so his nonsense people got to listen to and remember. And it's kind of fun to have that nonsense out there.
I think it is. But what do you think art is?
Oh, well, I have my definition. Do you actually have a definition for art?
I want to hear yours
Okay,
first.
I'll go first.
Okay.
I'll show mine first.
Okay, good.
There are a couple rules for what constitutes a work of art, and they're not set in stone. But these are the things when I look at something that I think of as art, these are the qualities that art has, generally speaking. One, it has a high degree of craft, which isn't always necessarily obvious. And two, really the other thing that it has to have is it has to have an emotional impact. And it has to have an emotional impact that isn't really kind of just second thought or just an accidental thing. Or, you know, if you feel sad for something that wasn't meant to be feel sad for because it was just so bad or whatever. Again, you don't have to specifically spell out the exact emotion that you're trying to engender in the in the audience because artists, whatever medium they have, you know, the verbal medium may not be their primary one, so they might not be able to verbalize it, or they might be creating an emotion that you can't describe really any other way. So those are the two tenets of art.
I would tend to agree with that. And in terms of the high craft, I do think that for me, it has to have some level of like technical proficiency, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were like trained as artists. I think there's a lot of naive art or different movements or art used in like therapeutic aspects.
Catherine, this is why you want to go first, because you had basically the same definition and then you could have gotten first mover points for that. But now I got to define it.
That's okay. I'm totally cool with
that. No. We have to figure out who's better. This is a competition.
No, it's not. Ugh. I'm not a competitive person.
Well, I am because I'm a male.
Okay.
Cleo.
Okay.
Do you mind not barking right now? Oh, I'm sorry. Now you're going to growl. Would you growl on mic, please?
So some technical proficiency that doesn't necessarily mean that they were trained in an art school.
But they train themselves.
But they train themselves.
A genuine artist will
train
themselves.
Right, and so I don't, you know, so, and I don't like the definitions or like when they, I shouldn't say I don't like it, but I do understand almost the chasm between what people would consider high art and decorative art. And I think some things can be, you know, pretty as wall decor.
Mm-hmm.
Or some things can move you in a way that... I've been in galleries like all over the country, and like there are some things that just move you and you just stare at them forever.
Or for as long as you can take it.
Or for as long as you can take it. And it just grabs you and you sense, and there's like a sense of movement, and you can almost sense that real personal expression. You know, that's the thing too, is like, is art just this personal expression? Like someone needing to basically like vomit on the canvas emotively with paint or with pastels or whatever you're doing, or, and what does that mean? Is
no.
it for them or is it for you?
No, that's my answer to your question. Is
okay.
that art? My response to that is no, that's not art. Art isn't just you trying to express yourself. Art is you expressing yourself and being successful at that expression.
Good definition.
Well, that's part of, you know, the emotional part impact.
Right.
If it doesn't have an emotional impact, it's not, you can
right.
do, you can do whatever you, I'm a painter.
Uh-huh.
And I don't consider my work art. I consider it decorative. I don't think it has an emotional impact. I like the way it looks.
I would say that 99% of anything I've ever done was the same.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it takes the pressure off. And it's easier to talk about once you realize that.
It is. It is. And then I don't get into that pretentious. I've hung out with a lot of artists who were very pretentious about, oh, that's just a decorative piece. Well, if it makes you happy... Or if it makes the wall pretty. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm not that snobby about it. Just
well, it's being real about it. And so the other thing that I've really come to like about my definition, it opens up the field of what art is. It's not just Andy Warhol kind of painting, right? It's not painting is just one form of art. And mm-hmm. let's be frank. I'm saying this as a painter. In the 20th and 21st centuries, painting is not the most impactful medium you can choose. There are much more impactful mediums these days.
Exactly.
So thinking of those two things, something that has that is built with craft and something that has an emotional impact, if those are the only two definitions for art, then I think we have a better understanding of the broader spectrum of art in our culture.
Yes.
With that in mind, who are some of your favorite artists?
Some of my favorite artists. All right. I can't name an artist because I think that this whole particular genre that has moved me more than anything, and it might surprise you, it might not. I was involved with the Bead Museum years ago in Glendale, and it's now defunct. It was a niche museum. And I remember walking back into the collection room the first time and just being floored by the graphic design of a lot of the beads from the 1800s that were traded. They call them African trade beads. I'm not sure that that's the correct term. Maybe it is. But the use of objects is a form of personal decor, decoration, personal adornment, probably was the most moving expression of art that whether it was a feather, a rock, or something that someone painted or cast in sand or did, you know, hundreds of years ago. And I have a large collection of that.
Mm-hmm.
And these little bits of art that were created by people long gone, that moves me to an extent that I don't know that other things have, looking at a wall or a big piece,
right.
even things that have moved me. And
so is it the personal connection there?
I think it's a personal connection. I remember sitting on the floor of the museum. We used to have Thursday nights was open beading, and we had a design group and we'd create pieces to sell, to raise money for a fundraiser for the Friends of the Museum. I remember sitting on the floor with a lot of these women, and we had the joy of creating our work, whatever we were doing, stringing or weaving or whatever, like literally sitting on the floor with all of this energy around us. And I was so struck that like it was such an opportunity to create with people while around stuff that people had created. And it was almost an anthropological scene.
Right. That's so interesting because it's a lot different than what I would see, the way I would see it. But that's, you know, part of it is very personal.
Right. It was very personal. And I remember because I walked into the store and one of my good friends still to this day, I walked into the store with someone else. We were looking for Swarovski crystals. And this gal, I don't know, we had some psychic connection. I don't want to get off on a rant about that. But she looked at me. She said, go back into the collections room. She goes, because everyone comes in here for the shiny pretty. But I think you'll find something else. Oh. I don't know how she knew that.
So she identified you as a...
as a
collector or...
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
What kind of crystal were you talking about? Just
Swarovski.
Like I don't know what that is.
They're like cut glass crystals. Okay. Swarovski created their cut glass. They're some high-end... You know, it's just shiny and pretty. And,
shiny and pretty.
Yeah. And so I walked back, and that's when I walked back into the accessions room. I remember the first thing I saw was this huge case they had with chunks of amber. Just big chunks of amber. And I thought it was just so organic and just so earthy. And then I walked around the whole thing and I came upon, you know, some of these beads, like with all this graphic design. I was just floored. And I went, I'm like, you're right. I didn't even want a Swarovski crystal from that point on. I'm like, oh no, give me, you know,
wow, you leveled
this
up.
Where's the, yeah, I leveled like instantly.
Well, see, that's the interesting thing when you, and this is why I like deconstructing what art is, because it opens up the floodgates of looking at things that actually are important or could be important. And the most common one I use as a reference is comedy. Most people don't think of that as an art form, but that is one of, as a modern art form, that's one of the most impactful because they can literally get you to have a physical and an emotional response from a good joke, right? I mean, you can't stop from laughing, which
I wouldn't have thought of that like that.
It's an amazing response to have. And if you think, I love this. Rodney Dangerfield once said something along the lines of, you know, he would do a 6-minute bit for Johnny Carson.
Right.
And he said it took him 6 months to make that 6 minutes. So that's the craft. I mean, people don't realize how much craft goes into a well-told joke. And Seinfeld is kind of the same way. He writes a joke every day. And he does that. He's done that for decades. So if you put the work in, you know, you'll get something back out of it. And the other thing, it makes it more accessible because in my opinion, I think everyone in some way or another, most people, I think at some point in their life do create something that is amazing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just, you make such an amazing muffin. I'm not joking about this. I mean, how many times have you had like an emotional response to food? It has an impact on me. So I think, you know, even if you just make a really good muffin, sometimes that could be art.
Right. I like your expanded definition. We've talked about this before, and you've referred to things as high craft.
Right. Well, see, that's the thing. A lot of cooking is high craft, but sometimes what takes it to the next level is if it actually gives you an emotional response.
Right.
So maybe I'm overstating with a muffin, but I feel like there's been some good food out there that has had, it's like, wow, this is, I can't eat. It's an emotion that really doesn't have any other equivalent, so you can't really take it into other fields. Or maybe it's a male thing. Maybe food has more of an impact.
No, I think the food, again, is just that human. Maybe what we're deciding here, no, I'm not deciding or like throwing about.
No, you're to decide. This is our podcast. You get to decide.
That art is more than, you know, splashing paint on the wall or someone telling you that Andy Warhol's work was the epitome of artistic success. And I think it's more the connection with people. Comedy connects people. Food connects people. The beads connected people across decades, centuries. And maybe that's what it is, more of a connection.
Well, that can be one element for it. And it seems like for you, that's a bigger element. And I don't know, maybe that's a gender thing.
I don't know if it's a gender thing. It may be a gender thing.
I don't know.
It may be.
Who knows? What is gender?
It's just a big topic now.
Well, let me just finish up one thing, then we'll talk about gender. Because I think we've opened that genie bottle.
You did.
Bottle of genies? Genie's bottle?
Out of the bottle.
Genie's bottle? I don't know. Anyway. So you mentioned Andy Warhol again. NPR again, a couple weeks ago, mentioned him. And his biographer, I think he published a biography of him last year. And it really triggered me because this biographer was said that Andy Warhol was the most important American artist of the 21st century, which I think couldn't be more wrong. I think it completely disregards so many other people who had so much more to impact both emotionally and culturally. I think that's one of the things that really bothers me about art is that people like that biographer think of art as being in this very kind of high strata, just for the people who go to the Whitney Museum.
Right. Right. Or they just swallow the Kool-Aid in terms of what they were told art is.
That is, yeah, to your point earlier where you said, you know, you thought Warhol was great for 15 seconds and then you start seeing for what it was. That's kind of one of the things that bothers me most about it is that I got sold that line as well when I was a kid. It's like, oh, this is one of the great artists. And then slowly having to deconstruct it myself and realizing, wait a second, is this really art? I don't have any response to this. It just doesn't seem to do anything for me. Is there something wrong with me? Is there something wrong with the art? It's kind of like being gaslit in a way.
I think that's exactly what it is. And that's what, in terms of like performance art, however we want to define that, it's like, what was the track? There was an exhibit of Warhol here in Phoenix not too long ago where they had a lot of his sketches from like childhood and different things you can kind of see. And there was talent there. I'm not going to say there isn't or wasn't. Or that it still is, you know, in print. But then you take it to the next level. And, you know, there's the whole persona. There's the whole, like, branding. You know, the hair, the wigs, the glasses, the clothing. You know, the slightness, the slumped shoulders, the sullen face. You know, whatever. And that's what I see when I see. I don't see his work. I see that person.
His persona, his brand.
I see the brand. I don't know. Are we so shallow as a society or so misunderstanding or so afraid to accept something outside of what they're telling you face value? You know, we're so bombarded with media and people tell you since you're 11 that Andy Warhol's the greatest artist of all time. And you kind of believe it without discerning, without investigating, without researching, without doing your own experiments. Experimenting with your own paint and seeing what you could do, what you can't do.
Well, that's one of the real problems with it. The art world is kind of rotten from the top down. This is a point I've harped on before, but in my other podcast, is that that's the problem with the art these days, is that it's rotten from the top down. The most successful artists in the world are just there, have built a brand around selling their work to wealthy people who have more money than taste. Is a dead shark in a gallery, is that art? Well, I've been there, I've seen it, and no, it's not. I'm sorry. Sorry to say, Damien Hirst, but that's not art, and you know, and you know it's not. He knows it's not. He knows it's just a big con job. He's played on these people, but kids and people who are trying to get into art or think they might want to be artists see this. That's what they're looking at. That's what they're trying to hit, and not realizing that it's a sham, unless they know. You know, unless they realize that it is just a marketing thing. In which case, you know, Jeff Koons followed Andy Warhol basically step for step, and you know. Is the continuation of pop art, even though pop art, you know, had its day in the early 60s, and that's pretty much all we needed. Yet somehow Koons has made a lifetime career out of it.
Agree.
So I think we've had enough of the contentious topics. Let's get to something a little bit lighter, like, I don't know, gender. So you pointed out earlier, I thought that was kind of interesting, how Barbie and did Barbie and G.I. Joe create the gender stereotypes for an entire generation? I thought that was an interesting question. Do you have an answer for that?
I just that popped into my head based on some things I've been experiencing recently surrounding gender, which I won't go into in great detail at all. But when you look at those dolls in terms of the body image, and I know they're changing it a lot. I'm talking like the Barbie one, you know, with the
We're looking back to the 20th century.
Yeah, we're looking back at the 20th century. You know, did it? And how was that even possible to have like male dolls with no genitalia and female dolls with like big breasts and like their feet were perpetually pointy to wear high heels? That hurts.
Yeah, I've never understood high heels.
So what was, you know, then you wear high heels and everyone gets breast implants. I don't know. Did it? Did it?
Well, no. Well, your point about G.I. Joe not having any genitalia, I never really thought about. I mean, you know, it's been a joke. It's been kind of a low-level joke for a long time. But when I was a kid, I had absolutely no recognition of that. I didn't think about it at all when I was playing with my G.I. Joe dolls. It didn't hit me at all that, oh, wait a second, I have some stuff down here and he doesn't. What's going on here? I didn't think about it. It was, and it may have been because I was just so blithe as a kid. There was a lot of stuff I missed.
Which is probably good.
Yeah. Well, that's the point, isn't it? It's like, you know what? Maybe these things that you say are really affecting people. really aren't affecting people because they just don't care. It's just not important.
Now, I don't know if it does or if it does in a subliminal way. I think with the female anatomy, perhaps more, and it had to have some impact. I mean, I don't know if it had to have some impact. Perhaps it had some impact with the, you know, the wokeness now, and they're changing the Barbie dolls and they're a little thicker, or, you know, there's even skin tone differences. I mean, that wasn't available with the first generation.
Yeah,
that.
And I have no problem with that. I mean,
and I have no problem
the original Barbie was really dumb, right? I mean, what is this thing? At least the G.I. Joe was proportioned like kind of like a man. Now, has that impacted me how I see people like Will Smith? There was this great scene in one of his movies, Legend,
right?
Which was just, I mean, it was a fine movie, but there was this one scene where he's doing pull-ups,
mm-hmm.
bare-chested. No need for this scene other than to show that this guy is completely ripped. And mm-hmm. at that moment, like, oh God, I'm never going to look like that. It's not that I felt inferior. It's just like, oh man, come on. My wife's sitting right here. And I don't get that feeling very often. Maybe that, I don't know if that's a gender thing or not. If one gender feels more triggered by that kind of thing or not. And it's not that I don't feel triggered, but there are some males I look at and it's like, oh God, okay, well that's a man. And you know, I'm never going to live up to that standard. Like Tom Selleck for me is like almost the perfect male, except for that mustache, which is a weird thing because that's such a main thing for him.
Yeah. I don't like facial hair.
Oh, well, thank you.
No,
I have a beard.
I didn't mean it like that.
My beard is very offended.
No, I mean that kind of facial.
My beard is walking off set right now.
Your beard is walking off set. I didn't mean it in that sense. In terms of like the Tom Selleck. It's just such a, like when you said Tom Selleck, I just saw him sitting there in the old Magnum PI.
Yes.
Set with that, you know, the baseball cap and that.
Mustache.
That mustache.
Chicago mustache.
And it just reminds me so much. It's just like, you know, 1970s porn or something. Oh, I mean, that's what I think. It's just like, so like, I don't like that kind of facial hair. Yours is fine.
Oh,
but
well,
that
thank
had
you.
Like some, that's that bushiness that we're, it's just such a, no, it's so rooted in that like time frame. It's like, oh man.
It's a great mustache, but I just never like those kind of bushy. I don't know why I associate them with Chicago, but I think of it as like a Chicago bushy mustache. But you know, he's 6'4".
Right.
But he's not, he's built, but he's not overbuilt. And he's got hair, but he's not over hairy. He's like, he's the perfect man.
He's just manly.
Yeah, he's amazing. Mm-hmm. Of course, the funny thing is, if you remember, Magnum P.I.?
I do.
Beautiful scenery in Hawaii. Beautiful, you know, they have TC flying this amazing helicopter. They have Magnum driving this amazing Ferrari. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the T-top Ferrari because he couldn't fit into a regular Ferrari.
I did not know that.
Yeah, Ferraris aren't made for big, tall people. This is the irony. It's like, yeah, okay, well, if you're that big, you're not going to enjoy the Ferrari. Me, I can fit into Ferrari because I'm not over 6 foot. I'm not some kind of freak of nature. I can fit. If you can't fit into Ferrari, maybe you should just rethink your life choices.
Completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Stop being so tall.
Stop being so tall.
You can have a couple inches of bone removed from here or there, right?
Right.
Get back down to my level.
Right. So I don't know where that came from, James. Thinking about Barbie dolls and gender. I think gender is just so in the news and so in the forefront right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I just...
That's heavy stuff, though.
It's just heavy stuff. And let's not go there today.
Okay. Fair enough. We can do Barbie. We can do G.I. Joe. But, oh, and that's the sad thing, right? I mean, they can't have sex.
Right.
These paradigms of sexual, I don't know, whatever, these sexual paradigms... themselves can't, they don't have the genitalia to actually have sex.
Exactly.
Isn't that
and
sad?
Why did they even need a boyfriend?
Oh, right, Ken.
Ken. And Ken and G.I. Joe, I think, were the same model. I think if you.
Oh, really?
I think it was
I have
same,
no idea.
Yeah, there were. I think it was the same body. I don't know about the heads, but I think it was the same molding. But
they were really cheap back. The toys were really cheap back in the 70s.
They were really cheap.
Did not, you know, they did as little work as they possibly. They reused tooling over and over and over
right.
again for this. You
right.
know. Well, you know, we have this superhero who's going to also be this superhero. We're just going to pay him differently.
Right. Yeah. So, I don't know. Why does she have a boyfriend? Why does she need a boyfriend?
Well, Barbie's because coupling home. Is important.
Maybe.
I thought so.
Well, sorry. What?
What?
I guess coupling is important.
Well, to me it was. Maybe, do you want to talk just a minute about this being the first time you came out of your house?
Yes, the pandemic.
Just you know, briefly.
No, thank you. It's so nice to see someone face to face, and I was a little freaked out.
I'm sorry, it's just me.
I don't know that my eye, where my eyes rolling back in my head when I got out of my car. I felt a little nervous.
Well, I was yelling at you.
Yeah, you were yelling
your,
at
your
me.
Playing your loud teen music.
I did.
Keep it
I
down.
Just, I rolled
please.
Up like I was, you know.
Miss.
18.
Yeah. You and your R.E.M. playing it like some kind of
it
teenager.
It was R.E.M., wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
I was screaming. I love that.
Were you screaming?
So,
you know, this is a quiet neighborhood. Young lady, you will respect our norms.
I used to live here. I miss this neighborhood so much. This was the only neighborhood I lived in Phoenix, because I live in like the north, what used to be suburbs right now. I don't know what the hell it is. But when I moved to this neighborhood, it was the first time that I actually knew my neighbors, that I knew people who weren't even my neighbors, that I'd walk around here, that people would look at you and talk to you. They'd walk their dogs. We lived a couple blocks up from you, right across from the Dwara, the Gurunanak Dwara.
Well, we have two of them.
Right. It was just right there. And I mean, there wasn't one week that went by and someone would come by and it's like, oh, we're having a wedding or having that, you know, you're always welcome. I mean, I never went, but I mean, it was week. It was just such as, you know, it's like, we're going to be parking on the street, you know, just all of this inclusion. And I just really thought that was beautiful. And I didn't feel, and I know a lot of my friends from North Scottsdale will come. It's like, oh, how do you live in that area?
What?
And I just loved it. It's like, I feel safe. I feel happy. I can walk down the street. I can go to Tuck Shop. I can walk up to McAlpine's. I can do all kinds of stuff. And I know people. I know the people who run these places. I know people's houses that I walk by. People talk to me.
This is really weird, though, because I'm from New York. And so for me, this is like suburbs, but it's close to downtown.
Right.
But people think of this as like being downtown.
Exactly.
Which is weird to me because it's just a bunch of little houses.
Well, I think it's that proximity. Like, arts district.
It's the proximity, but it's a matter of perspective too. If you're from New York and you say you live in the city, that means you live in a high rise and there are nothing but high rises next to you, or maybe brownstones.
Right.
Not little houses built in the 40s.
Right. But you look at the Phoenix skyline, which I looked at as I was driving here on the freeway, and it's still pretty tiny.
Yeah.
You know, there's not that much. And so there's not that much high rise. Like they kind of spread out instead of like going up and doing tons of buildings.
I'm just saying, I think Phoenix needs to level up a little bit if it wants to be considered a big city with a big downtown.
I've been saying that since forever.
And of course, a couple of years ago, almost my entire neighborhood was up in arms because they were going to build a 13-floor apartment complex not far from me. I was like, guys, this is what happens. You want to build up, not out.
Right. But I think they just had so much land here. But Phoenix, when we moved here, and I was so young when we moved from Chicago. And it was, my mother would just cry. It's like, this is a cultural desert. It's not just a desert, it's a cultural desert. And she would, you know, we'd go back every summer so I can go to the art museums and walk around and have an experience, whatever.
That's crazy. We have a football team. We have a baseball team. We have a hockey team. How can this be the cultural desert?
It was a cultural desert to my mother. She never let anyone forget it. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But it always felt like an adolescent to me. Like Phoenix didn't feel like a grown-up city. And I think it's losing some of that as people move from other places, but it just felt like it wasn't fully formed. It almost felt like an encampment where people came from other places, and then you'd find people who were like you. Like a lot of my friends in college were from the Midwest.
Well, it's hard to measure up to larger cities that have been in place for hundreds of years versus Phoenix, which has just sprung up. You know, I talk to people all the time about, oh, when I was a kid, you know, there was farms on Camelback, which isn't that far from where I am now. So things change.
Things do change. Things do change.
Thank you for coming over, Catherine.
Thank you. This was fun.
See you next. Well, I hope it wasn't too fun. I was trying to make it, you know, combative.
No,
And who's the winner today? We gotta keep score.
You?
This is the masculine gender here.
It's your house.
Oh. Well, that doesn't count if you just give it to me. I don't just want it like that. Fine.
But no, this was a good first experience.
Okay.
My first pandemic.
First time.
Wandering.
I was trying to be gentle.
It was just, it was hard. I mean, this has been it's been a trip of a year.
Okay. If I say I'm trying to be gentle, don't follow up by, it was hard. Really? This is supposed to be a family friendly.
My mind is just going crazy.
This is supposed to be a family friendly show.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, James.
Bye.
Bye.